Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program is designed for people learning English. Today, Phil Dierking and I tell about American old-time music, a sound and style that developed in the Appalachian Mountains. We also listen to a short segment of What It Takes, a podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. Today's subject is chemical engineer and inventor Robert Langer. And we close the show with an American story. Today we hear the first part of Hearts and Crosses by O. Henry. But first, this report.
Zimbabwe election officials have declared Emmerson Mnangagwa winner of the country's presidential election. Mnangagwa received 50.8% of the vote compared to 44.3% for his opponent, Nelson Chamisa, the Election Commission reported early Friday. The 75-year-old Mnangagwa is a member of the ruling party of Zimbabwe's longtime former leader, Robert Mugabe. Mugabe ruled the country for 37 years before the country's military pressured him to resign in November. President Mnangagwa said he was humbled by his win. "Though we may have been divided at the polls, we are united in our dreams," Mnangagwa said on Twitter. Chamisa, leader of the opposition Movement for Democratic Change, or MDC party, rejected the results. On Twitter, he criticized the Election Commission for releasing unverified fake results. Chamisa said the party planned to fight the election outcome in court. The voting began Monday and was mostly peaceful, unlike past elections. But deadly violence broke out at a demonstration Wednesday in the capital, Harare. Military forces fired at demonstrators protesting unfair voting practices. At least 6 people were killed and 14 injured. Mnangagwa called for an independent investigation into Wednesday's violence, saying those responsible should be identified and brought to justice. Police said 18 people were arrested at offices of the MDC party. The suspects were accused of possession of dangerous weapons, and public violence, the Associated Press reported. Hours after Mnangagwa was declared the winner, riot police attempted to stop a press conference in Harare where Chamisa was commenting on the results. Trucks arrived with police carrying heavy sticks into a hotel where the press conference was being held, the Associated Press reported. The officers first tried to force out about 100 local and international press members covering the event, the AP said. It said later the police withdrew. I'm Brian Lynn.
To me, the difference between a violin and a fiddle is that a violin never had a beer spilled on it. That is the difference.
Will Fanning laughs at his joke as he rocks on his chair outside his home in Mingo, West Virginia. Fanning is a musician and hotel owner born in Ireland. But now, he lives deep in the Appalachian Mountains of the United States. The Irish, nearly every day, have a song and play music, said Fanning. So that tradition is kind of bred into me. My family, every weekend, we'd play music at the house. Like Fanning, many in the area continue the traditions from their family's immigrant history, including a kind of music called old time.
Old time music comes from the Appalachian Mountains, a 2,400-kilometer-long system of mountains along the eastern part of the United States. In the 18th century, many Europeans from Ireland, Scotland, and Germany arrived in the area to begin new lives. The U.S. was now their home, but these Appalachian communities continued the European music and dance traditions they loved. Over time, the music mixed with that of African slaves and became its own. It is called old-time music. Jerry Milnes is a musician and folklorist from Elkins, West Virginia. He says the culture of the Appalachian people has survived throughout time because they lived far from other groups.
The sort of earliest culture that arrived here in that period has really maintained those old traditions. It's both dialect and music and customs and traditions and folkways of all kinds have a particular Appalachian sensibility to them.
The instruments used to make old-time music usually include guitar, banjo, fiddle, mandolin, and bass. Old-time music, you can hear fiddle tunes that have been played pretty much the same way for a couple hundred years, Milnes said. Professional musician John Lilly of Charleston, West Virginia, plays old-time and country music. He says the earliest purpose of the music was for dancing. Life in the mountains was hard work. Music and dancing provided Appalachians a much-needed break from the labors of the day. And it brought members of different generations together. Emily Miller, another local West Virginian musician, says that in small Appalachian towns in the past, there was always an old fiddler or musician in the neighborhood. Young people would study the art under him or her. Richard Hefner, a musician from Lewisburg, West Virginia, is in the Black Mountain Bluegrass Boys Band. He says his community often enjoyed music in groups.
A lot of people would just meet at their houses and move the furniture back and dance in the living room and, like I say, roll up the rug. And that still goes on in our family.
High school student Silas Riley and his sister Hazel are learning to play banjo. Old-time music is learned by ear, Silas said. It's a lot harder than other music. There's no written stuff, no written notes, so you have to learn it all by listening to it and trying to reproduce the sound, Silas said. Silas adds that old-time musicians might not read music, but they can still easily put a song together. You can just listen to it and then play it, he said.
Old-time songs are records of history. Some, called spirituals, are based in the Christian religion. Others are American Civil War songs. And many are about the life and land that surround the songwriter, says Hefner. Some of the words of the songs have so much to do with the area. The hills, mountains, streams, and rivers, the old log cabin, and real gruesome ones about murder and things like that, Hefner said. But some of the earliest songs go back to the music's European roots. Patrick O'Flaherty was born in Ireland, but now lives in Lewisburg, West Virginia. He owns an Irish restaurant there and plays Irish music in his band, the Poor Clares. Flaherty says that when he hears old-time music, he recognizes songs that he heard growing up in Ireland.
Lots of the tunes of the old-time music and the bluegrass, you hear the Scottish reels, the Scottish jigs, or the Irish reels and the Irish jigs. I can nearly tell where that came from. The root is there.
Reels and jigs are forms of music and dance.
It is a sunny day at the Augusta Heritage Festival in West Virginia.
The first thing you ever learn on the clawhammer banjo is the basic strum. And the way to hold your hand, if you've ever, like, I usually tell people how they hold an axe, if you're splitting wood or something, that's how you hold your hand. So after you learn that, you can just really play anything.
Trevor Hammonds is describing how to play the banjo. The Hammonds family is an important part of old-time music in West Virginia. They came from Kentucky and settled in the area just before the Civil War. Hammonds family musicians wrote many of the songs that people play in West Virginia today. Trevor is in high school and first became interested in music after listening to an album that had a photo of his great-grandfather, Lee Hammonds, on the cover. Trevor quickly learned to play the banjo. His style is often compared to that of his great-grandfather's. "They say my hand is just like his," Trevor said. "People say it's like I'm his shadow or something." What he likes best about the old-time music culture is its hopefulness. With this music, you never really meet a person with negativity, Trevor says. They all kind of are like a big family, a special bond you get when you sit around and jam and play.
These days, old-time music is not often heard over the radio, but it still lives on strongly in the communities where it came from. Organizations like the Mountain Music Trail have created a record of events and places people can visit to experience this rich part of American history. A history that Miller says is important to the identity of the people.
So I think that there's a real pride in what the people of Appalachia have made together. And the music specifically is just something that everybody kind of identifies with. This region has hard times. We've been going through economic transition, but the music has stuck with us through it all.
Chemistry just is so fundamental to everything. I mean, it makes the clothes you wear. It makes all the materials that exist in, you know, synthetic materials in the world, our cars, the airplanes, everything, you know, is done by chemistry. Reactions can happen and you can make things that you could never make before. And at the same time, chemistry provides a tool to understand so many things, how cells work, how drugs work, you know, and so to me, it's just like such an incredibly fundamental science.
But it's a science that Robert Langer has taken in some entirely unconventional directions. Here he is in 2014 describing to students at an Academy of Achievement summit the twists and turns, the swamplands and summits along his remarkable path.
I got my degree in chemical engineering at MIT in 1974, and I wasn't sure what I wanted to do, but at that time, just like a couple of years ago, there was this gas shortage and the prices of gas kept going up. But in Boston, it was even worse. If you had a car, you actually had to wait in line at the gas station for about 2 hours to fill it up. But the consequence of all that is that if you were a chemical engineer, you got a lot of job offers. And pretty much every one of my friends actually decided to go to an oil company. And I thought that's what I should do too, because that's basically what everybody did. So, and they were visiting MIT and they gave a lot of offers. So I actually did get 20 job offers from oil companies, 4 actually from Exxon alone. And one of them actually, though, made quite an impression on me. I remember going to Exxon in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and they said, you know, gee, if you could just increase the yield of this one chemical by 0.1%, they said this would be wonderful. It'd be worth billions. And I just remember flying back to Boston that night thinking to myself that I really didn't want to do that. So what did I want to do? Well, I had this dream of using my background in chemical engineering to improve people's lives. And one of the things I did when I was a graduate student, even when I was supposed to be doing my thesis, is I helped start a school for poor children in Cambridge and got involved in developing a lot of new chemistry and math curricula. And one day I actually saw an ad from City College of New York to be an assistant professor to do just that in chemistry. So I wrote them a letter applying for a job, but they didn't write me back. But I really liked that idea of being assistant professor of chemistry education. I found about 40 ads, and I wrote to all of them, and actually none of them wrote me back. I guess I wasn't in the right box. So I started to think about other ways that I could use my background to help improve people's lives, and I thought about medicine. So I applied to a lot of hospitals and medical schools, and they didn't write me back either.
You can find the whole podcast on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com.
Hearts and Crosses. Baldy Woods reached for a drink and got it. When Baldy wanted something, he usually got it. But this is not Baldy's story. Now he took his third drink, which was larger than the first and the second. Baldy had been listening to the troubles of a friend. Now Baldy was going to tell his friend what to do. So the friend was buying him the drinks. This was the right thing for the friend to do. "I'd be king if I were you," said Baldy. He said it loudly and strongly. Webb Yeager moved his wide hat back on his head. He put his fingers in his yellow hair and moved it about. It now looked wilder than before. But this did not help him to think better. Therefore, he also got another drink.
"If a man marries a queen, it ought not make him nothing," said Webb. Here was his real problem.
"Surely not," said Baldy. "You ought to be a king, but you're only the queen's husband. That's what happens to a man in Europe if he marries the king's daughter. His wife becomes a queen, but is he a king? No. His only duty is to appear with the queen in pictures and be the father of the next king. That's not right. Yes, Webb, you are only the queen's husband. And if I were you, I'd turn everything upside down and I would be king."
Baldy finished his drink.
"Baldy," said Webb, "you and I have been cowboys together for years. We've been riding the same road since we were very young. I wouldn't talk about my family to anyone but you. You were working on the Nopalito Ranch when I married Santa McAllister. I was foreman then. What am I now? Nothing."
"Well, when old McAllister was cattle king of West Texas," continued Baldy, "you were important. You told people what to do. Your commands were as strong as his."
"That was true," said Webb, "until he discovered that I wanted to marry Santa. Then he sent me as far away from the ranch house as he could. When the old man died, they started to call Santa the cattle queen. Now, I tell the cattle what to do. That's all. She takes care of all the business. She takes care of all the money. I can't sell any cattle, not one animal. Santa is the queen, and I'm nothing."
"I would be king if I were you," said Baldy Woods again. "When a man marries a queen, he ought to be the same as she is. Plenty of people think it's strange, Webb. Your words mean nothing on the Nopalito Ranch. Mrs. Yeager is a fine little lady, but a man ought to be the head of his own house."
Webb's brown face grew long with sadness.
With that expression in his wild yellow hair and his blue eyes, he looked like a schoolboy who had lost his leadership to another strong boy. Yet his tall body looked too strong for such a thing to happen to him.
"I'm riding back to the ranch today," he said. It was easy to see that he did not want to go. "I have to start some cattle on the road to San Antonio tomorrow morning." "Well, I'll go with you as far as Dry Lake," said Baldy.
The two friends got on their horses and left the little town where they had met that morning. At Dry Lake, they stopped to say goodbye. They had been riding for miles without talking. But in Texas, talk does not often continue steadily. Many things may happen between words. But when you begin to talk again, you're still talking about the same thing. So now Webb added something to the talk that began 10 miles away.
"You remember, Baldy, there was a time when Santa was different. You remember the days when old McAllister kept me away from the ranch house. Remember how she would send me a sign that she wanted to see me? Old McAllister said that he would kill me if I came near enough. You remember the sign she used to send, Baldy? The picture of a heart with a cross inside it?"
"Me?" cried Baldy. "Sure, I remember. Every cowboy on the ranch knew that sign of the heart and the cross. We would see it on things sent out from the ranch. We would see it on anything. It would be on newspapers, on boxes of food. Once I saw it on the back of the shirt of a cook that McAllister sent from the ranch."
"Santa's father made a promise that she wouldn't write to me or send me any word. That heart and cross sign was her plan. When she wanted to see me, she would put that mark on something that she knew I would see. And when I saw it, I traveled fast to the ranch that same night. I would meet her outside the house."
"Now, we all knew it," said Baldy. "But we never said anything. We wanted you to marry Santa. We knew why you had that fast horse. When we saw the heart and the cross on something from the ranch, we always knew your horse was going to go fast that night."
"The last time Santa sent me the sign," said Webb, "was when she was sick. When I saw it, I got on my horse and started. It was a 40-mile ride. She wasn't at our meeting place. I went to the house. Old McAllister met me at the door.
'Did you come here to get killed?' he said. 'I won't kill you this time. I was going to send for you. Santa wants you. Go in that room and see her. Then come out here and see me.'"
Santa was lying in bed very sick, but she smiled and put a hand in mine, and I sat down by the bed, mud and riding clothes and all.
"I could hear you coming for hours, Webb," she said. "I was sure you would come. You saw the sign?"
"I saw it," I said.
"It's our sign," she said. "Hearts and crosses, to love and to suffer. That's what they mean."
And old Dr. Musgrove was there. And Santa goes to sleep, and Dr. Musgrove touches her face, and he says to me,
"You were good for her, but go away now. The little lady will be all right in the morning."
Old McAllister was outside her room. "She's sleeping," I said. "Now you can start killing me. You have plenty of time. I haven't anything to fight with." Old McAllister laughs and says to me,
"Killing the best foreman in West Texas is not good business. I don't know where I could get another good foreman. I don't want you in the family, but I can use you on the Nopalito if you stay away from the ranch house. You go up and sleep. And then we'll talk."
The two men prepared to separate. They took each other's hand.
"Bye, Baldy," said Webb. "I'm glad I saw you and had this talk."
With a sudden rush, the two riders were on their way. Then Baldy pulled his horse to a stop and shouted. Webb turned.
"If I were you,"
came Baldy's loud voice,
"I would be king."
At 8 the following morning, Bud Turner got off his horse at the Nopalito Ranch House. Bud was the cowboy who was taking the cattle to San Antonio.
Mrs. Yeager was outside the house putting water on some flowers. In many ways, Santa was like her father, King McAllister. She was sure about everything. She was afraid of nothing. She was proud. But Santa looked like her mother. She had a strong body and a soft prettiness. Because she was a woman, her manners were womanly. But she liked to be queen, as her father had liked to be king. Webb stood near her, giving orders to two or three cowboys. "Good morning," said Bud. "Where do you want the cattle to go? To Barber's, as usual?" The queen always answered such a question. All the business, buying, selling, and banking, had been held in her hands. Care of the cattle was given to her husband. When King McAllister was alive, Santa was his secretary and his helper. She had continued her work, and her work had been successful. But before she could answer, the queen's husband spoke.
"You drive those cattle to Zimmerman's and Nesbitt's. I spoke to Zimmerman about it."
Bud turned, ready to go.
"Wait,"
called Santa quickly. She looked at her husband with surprise in her gray eyes.
"What do you mean, Webb?"
she asked.
"I never deal with Zimmerman and Nesbitt. Barber has bought all the cattle from this ranch for 5 years. I'm not going to change."
She said to Bud Turner,
"Take those cattle to Barber."
Bud did not look at either of them. He stood there waiting.
"I want those cattle to go to Zimmerman and Nesbitt," said Webb.
There was a cold light in his blue eyes.
"It's time to start," said Santa to Bud. "Tell Barber we'll have more cattle ready in about a month."
Bud allowed his eyes to turn and meet Webb's.
"You take those cattle," said Webb,
"to Barber,"
said Santa quickly.
"Let's say no more about it. What are you waiting for, Bud?"
"Nothing," said Bud. But he did not hurry to move away, for man is man's friend. And he did not like what had happened.
"You heard what she said," cried Webb. "We do what she commands."
He took off his hat and made a wide movement with it, touching the floor.
"Webb," said Santa, "what's wrong with you today?"
"I'm acting like the queen's fool," said Webb. "What can you expect? Let me tell you, I was a man before I married a cattle queen. What am I now? Something for the cowboys to laugh at. But I'm going to be a man again."
Santa looked at him.
"Be reasonable, Webb," she said quietly. "There's nothing wrong. You take care of the cattle, I take care of the business. You understand the cattle. I understand the business better than you do. I learned it from my father."
"I don't like kings and queens," said Webb, "unless I'm one of them myself. All right, it's your ranch. Barber gets the cattle."
Webb's horse was tied near the house. He walked into the house and brought out the supplies he took on long rides. These he began to tie on his horse. Santa followed him. Her face had lost some of its color. Webb got on his horse. There was no expression on his face except a strange light burning in his eyes.
"There's some cattle at the Hondo waterhole," he said. "They ought to be moved. Wild animals have killed three of them. I did not remember to tell Sims to do it. You tell him."
Santa put a hand on the horse and looked her husband in the eye.
"Are you going to leave me, Webb?"
she asked quietly.
"I'm going to be a man again," he answered.
"I wish you success,"
she said with a sudden coldness. She turned and walked into the house. Webb Yeager went to the southeast as straight as he could ride. And when he came to the place where the sky and the earth seemed to meet, he was gone. Those at the Nopalito knew nothing more about him. Days passed, then weeks, then months. But Webb Yeager did not return.
And that is our show for today. We'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver.